A military factory in central Iran is hit by drones. Some US media say Israel was responsible. A former Israeli security official tells us how this type of operation could be in Israel's interest.
You can do things that are going to hurt Iran. You are not putting a finger in the eyes of the Russians, and you can help the war in Ukraine.
Plus, an internet freedom researcher describes how Iran is fighting back against U.S. tech companies that help Iranians get online with virtual private networks.
The regime is trying to automate the ways of tracking protocols and blocking them. So it is very much so a cat and mouse game between the two.
And later in the program, we'll hear about new ways of promoting Holocaust education in Iran, where leaders engage in Holocaust denial. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning, I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran has condemned a drone strike on a military building in the central city of Isfahan late Saturday. It said the ammunition manufacturing plant suffered little damage. In a social media video that appears to show the moment of the attack, a strong blast can be seen above the building. U.S. media quoted unnamed U.S. officials as saying Israel carried out the drone strike. Israel has not commented, but the attack appears to fit a pattern of suspected covert Israeli operations in Iran in recent years. Israeli Reserve Brigadier General Jacob Nagel is a former Israeli National Security Advisor and a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He told me on the phone that Israel has been broadening its strategy of targeting those in Iran who cause damage to the Jewish state.
It became more and more and more. Israel is not retaliating only against the nuclear program of Iran, but also against the other systems that Iran is developing. It can be UAVs sending to the Russians to attack Ukraine, and it can be weapons that they are preparing to send in the future to Israel, and of course it can be part of the nuclear program. Everything that Iran is doing to hurt Israel or to hurt other places, it's okay. And here, I call it, and even Mark Dubovich, the CEO of our organization, just wrote about it, I think, in the Wall Street Journal today. It's really a very, very win-win trifecta that you can do things that are going to hurt Iran. You are not putting a finger in the eyes of the Russians, and you can help the war in Ukraine by doing things. For example, if a few months ago someone attacked a UAV factory or a production facility in Iran and made sure that 250 UAVs will go out of order, it will help. So Iran can send less UAVs to the Russians in Ukraine. And Israel is not really asked to send its very sensitive technologies to Ukraine, so it will jeopardize Israel's technology superiority and, you know, a transfer or a fallout of some Israeli technologies to the hands of Russians and then, of course, Iranians. So everything is being connected together. And what is exactly in this factory, we can talk about, but it's never mind if it was a ballistic missiles, if it was part of the nuclear program, if it was UAVs. It was one of those things that I just talked about.
The Israeli TV networks were reporting on Monday that Israeli officials are anticipating preparing for some kind of potential response from the Iranian side. Iran has not officially blamed Israel, as far as I know, for carrying out this strike. But how concerned should Israel be that there could be some kind of Iranian retaliation for this?
Iran cannot blame Israel because I don't see any proves that Israel was involved. Even so, this is the life being an Israeli official or not official. We have to be alerted. We have to be ready all the time. The Iranians tried last time after there was an attack to do things against Israeli facilities, Israeli cities. You know, they tried to send some missiles from Syria to Israel. It was a failed one, but Israel reacted very, very, very harsh. And again, if someone will attack us from Syria or from Lebanon, We are not going to wait. We are going to claim responsibility and will retaliate very hard, immediately and very hard against someone that will try to attack Israel borders or Israel cities or Israel civilian or Israel military. This is what happened last time. But I'm sure that the Iranians are deterred. They know exactly that Israel will retaliate. And if they didn't learn it yet, they will learn it again, that Israel know how to defend itself by itself any place in the world.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu talked about the issue of Iran with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Jerusalem on Monday. Netanyahu said they had very good discussions about a common policy to deal with Iran, and Antony Blinken said that the two of them discussed deepening cooperation to confront and counter Iran's destabilizing activities. What do you think this deepening cooperation means in practice, and how close do you think the U.S. and Israeli governments really are when it comes to dealing with Iran?
First of all, I will be very glad if what you said, it will become fully true and happening. I'm not sure, but I hope so. I think that it's time to do at least three or four things. First of all, to hardening the pressure on Iran, the economical pressure, it should be very, very, very hard. And if you read my last article together with Mark Dubovich and others in Newsweek and in Israel, the press, we have to support the protests in Iran. We have to make sure it will not go down. I'm not hesitating to say so. We have to give them good intelligence. We have to help them economically. And we have even to help them practically by, I don't know, sending some very simple means that they can really work against this besiege and IRGC that are killing them. And we have to make sure that the Iranians will understand that there is a credible military threat on the table. So we have to do all those things together. Economical pressure, support the protesters, and be ready for a military credible threat. Israel will have to do it alone, we'll do it alone, but it's much, much better to do it together with the US and with our other allies. You ask me if I believe it will happen, I don't know.
Well, we shall see. Brigadier General Reserve and Professor Jacob Nagel, Senior Fellow at FDD, speaking to us from New Zealand. Thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it as always, and you are welcome to do it whenever you need.
Opposition activists in Iran are facing a growing challenge in trying to share images of anti-government protests with the outside world. Internet freedom advocates say Iranian authorities have been taking a more selective approach to blocking online activity by protesters in recent months. Mahsa Alimardani is a senior researcher with the Britain-based Article 19 group. She told me by phone that instead of shutting down the internet completely, Iran has been blocking Western apps and Western tools that Iranians use to circumvent those blockages.
What we have been seeing is a very strong reliance and a lot of investment in censorship this time around, as opposed to shutdown. So we have seen them, you know, block a lot of platforms, which typically, you know, Iranians are quite tech savvy, so they would turn to circumvention tools. But we've been seeing very sophisticated technology developed to then now block circumvention tools. So without access to proper circumvention tools and with everything blocked, there have been moments of, you know, complete disconnections when you can't get a circumvention tool to work. So that has been one of the main strategies that we've been seeing. And it's one of the kind of consistent problems. It had continued before September, but it has seriously picked up in terms of this new aggressive kind of censorship, not only against applications on the websites, but blocking circumvention tools.
You were saying that the Iranian government has not relied so much recently on total internet shutdowns. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so this is also a really interesting development, because obviously there has been the legacy of November 2019, a very bloody period, a bloody week that happened, where we did see, you know, near total shutdowns nationwide where the internet was disconnected for most Iranians, almost all Iranians, while, you know, what is suspected to have been over 1,500 deaths of protesters at the hands of the Islamic Republic. So what we have seen that happened, you know, just immediately after the death of Mahsa or Jina Amini on September 16th, I believe it was, we saw a protest start. We are now speaking at the end of January, and this is very much still continuing. A lot of the restrictions that were put into place because of these protests are still there on the internet. Just practically speaking, it would not make sense for a regime to be sustaining internet shutdowns for this long. After the week-long shutdowns that were endured in 2019, somewhere between $1 to $2 billion was estimated to have been lost financially. So it has very much been part of the thinking and policy making of the regime to reduce these kinds of costs. And since November 2019, we have been seeing the development of a lot of different internet policies to, of course, not make repression less, but to make it more efficient. And so, you know, one of these policies has been the development of the User Protection Bill. The User Protection Bill has yet to actually be passed in Parliament. It hasn't really had much political will. It's deeply unpopular by, you know, the Iranian population. There have been, you know, online protests and different kinds of backlash against this bill, which essentially is trying to, you know, legalize the nationalization of the internet. You know, if foreign companies don't cooperate, they will be blocked. And we have basically seen this happen. But the main element of the User Protection Bill is criminalizing the use of VPNs, virtual private networks, or circumvention tools, and developing means to severely technologically and legally restrict the use of VPNs. And so at Article 19, we had been kind of monitoring the different ways in which they were trying to control the internet without having to turn to full-scale internet shutdowns.
How effectively has Iran been trying to stop the use of VPNs? And in terms of the makers of these circumvention tools, you know, have they been coming up with new ways to sort of get around what Iran is trying to do to them?
Yeah, of course. I mean, circumvention tools, a lot has been done to develop them. And I'm sure if you talk to a number of different companies, you know, for-profit or non-profit, they can illustrate what they have kind of developed, especially trying to go head-to-head with the sophisticated ways that, you know, the regime is trying to automate the ways of tracking protocols and blocking them. So it is very much so a cat and mouse game between the two. But when you do talk to users, this has been an overriding problem of figuring out which VPNs on which protocols will work at the right time. So this is a major hurdle. Hasn't meant that people have disconnected completely, but it has meant that there has to be a lot more effort. So this does essentially mean that every time we look at a piece of footage online, a lot of thought and effort had to get into that coming online. The right, you know, connection, the right bandwidth, the right VPN had to be used for that to happen. And, you know, you can talk to Iranians and they'll tell you, like, they've had to download 30 or 40 new VPNs over the past few months just to make sure that one of them will work.
So who do you think is winning this cat and mouse game between the tech companies making the circumvention tools and the Iranian authorities who are trying to block them?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. It's very hard to document exactly what every single internet user in Iran is doing. It's certainly brought the threshold much higher in terms of, you know, the effort and time people take to do this. But we can tell, like, there's still tons of content coming out of Iran. So it's still working. But it is very much the tip of the iceberg, a lot of the stuff that we see and we are able to document, because this means that, you know, there is a whole like demographic of people who haven't been able to find those right tools, haven't had the time or the resources to find those tools to be able to contribute to, you know, the online discourse or the documentation or the reporting. And, you know, obviously beyond the technological factors, there's also, you know, other kinds of censorship that occurs. You know, there's fear, there's pressure, and a lot of people obviously don't want to get involved. You know, we've noted a number of protesters who go out on the streets and don't even take devices out with them because they don't want the possibility of being tracked through SIM cards or cell towers or be found with any kind of photos or documentation to later persecute them. So there are all of these different hurdles. Obviously, it's hard to say that, okay, on this day, we probably would have had like a million more pieces of content from this massacre, but it is a significant hurdle that they are putting in place there. People are rerouting around that, but it does beg the question of if these hurdles weren't there, what more would we be able to capture?
Mahsa Alimardani, senior researcher at Article 19, speaking to us from the UK. Thanks so much for sharing all of that great information with our audience, and good to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington marked International Holocaust Remembrance Day last week by launching a new phase of a project to promote Holocaust education in Iran. Since 2016, the museum has worked with Iranian journalist Mazyar Bahari and his Iran Wire news site to counter efforts by Iran's Islamist rulers to deny the Holocaust through anti-Semitic rhetoric, books, and TV programs. I spoke with Bahari by phone on Friday and asked how he got involved in the project.
So since I've always been interested in the Holocaust, and I think I know a lot about the Holocaust, I thought that it's a pity that there is not enough information about the Holocaust in Persian. Even if there is some information, you know, it's scattered in different places and there is no one single source of material for Holocaust education in Persia. And when the Holocaust Museum got in touch with me in 2016, I believe, I was glad that they contacted me. So we started to make an animation first and then made a documentary about the Holocaust and the museum. And my argument was always that, you know, it's very good to do one-off things, but we have to be consistent because nobody's mind is going to change if you make a film every now and then, every 2 or 3 years or so, or if you write an article every 2 or 3 years or so. There has to be a series of articles. There has to be a consistent production as in order to sustain that momentum and sustain people's attention. And because of that, we started Sardari Project, which is a project, educational project in Persian to teach young Iranians, especially about the Holocaust, through videos and articles and social media posts. In 2020, we started Sardari Project, and today we are launching the third phase of Sardari Project.
What kind of audience are you targeting with the Sardari Project? You mentioned young Iranians, but are we talking about Iranian youths in Iran itself or in the diaspora or both?
Mostly Iranians inside Iran, mostly young Iranians between the ages of 18 to 35. And from our statistics that we have, I think Instagram is the best way to get the statistics of Iran. We can see that we've been relatively successful in reaching that audience. And sometimes we've been surprisingly successful because, as you know, there is a great deal of censorship in Iran. And also, our website is blocked in Iran, so people have to go through VPNs. But we've been sometimes really surprised by people's interest. For example, last year, a group of university students in Iran sent us an email saying that we've been studying different subjects every year. And this year, because of what you've been publishing, we are going to study the Holocaust. And they even suggested certain topics for us to work on. That was really interesting. And then we received another email from a mullah who is interested in knowing more about the Holocaust. We are receiving, you know, many emails and messages about people being interested in the subject of the Holocaust. And I think in a perverse way, the Iranian government itself has been the best promoter of Holocaust education in Iran. Since Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president in 2005, he started to deny the Holocaust. And then the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has made it his mission to deny Holocaust on an annual basis. And then President Raisi last year at the UN denied the Holocaust. People, especially young people, are naturally interested to know more about the Holocaust and want to know what is it that the Iranian government denies.
Right. And when these people in Iran tell you that they're interested in the topic, they want to learn more, they're going to do their own independent study, do they express any concern that if they engage in, let's say, more public or open study of what really happened in the Holocaust, that they could get in trouble from the Iranian authorities who maintain this Holocaust denial policy?
Well, you know, the Iranian people, they've been under the threat of censorship and intimidation and persecution for the past four decades. And they are doing many things surreptitiously, and studying the Holocaust is one of them. I'm sure if they go out and they talk about the fact that they're studying, you know, the Holocaust, or they are reading IranWire, they would be in trouble, but of course they don't. Yeah.
In terms of the Sardari project, you mentioned that today you're launching a new phase of content. So what can we expect to see from your project going forward? What is this new content going to look like?
So we've been trying to see how can we attract more young people on social media, especially to our content. And we realized that we have to produce more visual material. And we thought that it would be good to concentrate on photographs. So one part of the project is a series called Photos That Define the Holocaust. There are 70 photos selected by historians at the Holocaust Museums and students at the Holocaust Museum. And they show different parts of the history of the Holocaust from pre-World War ordinary lives of Jews in Germany and Eastern Europe to Hitler's rehearsal for his speeches, and then the Nazis coming to power between 1933 and 1942, and then, of course, photos of, you know, after the final solution as well in 1942. So this is a very, I think, exciting series. And the series is mostly, of course, it's about 6 million Jews who were perished during the Second World War. But also we have photographs of Roma and gay people who were perished during the Holocaust. So we talk about different aspects of the Holocaust.
Right, so it sounds like a very comprehensive project. Maziar Bahari, journalist and documentary filmmaker and founder of IranWire.com, on the line from London. Thanks for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.